You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Fads and craziness often start in California and work their way east. Some of the fads are great fun. Think of hula hoops, Barbies, and the green energy movement. Some, however, can have potential dire, unexpected side effects, such as the movement of local municipalities to regulate the relationship of veterinarians and the pet owner. Several California cities have made it illegal for a veterinarian to declaw a domestic cat. My guest today, the executive director of the Southern California Veterinary Medical Association, Dr. Peter Weinstein, and veterinary behaviorist Dr. Roland Tripp, will discuss the legal, ethical, and behavioral aspects of this emotionally charged topic. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
It's time for school for you and your friends, your furry best friends. Train your dog the fun and easy way with Teacher's Pet Sessions. Teacher's Pet host Pia Silvani teaches you step by step how to train your dog the fun and easy way. You get 8 30-minute live audio training sessions, complete transcripts of each session, plus a basic training manual to get you and your dog off to a great start. Training begins the moment you bring your dog home. Teacher's Pet Sessions offers positive reinforcement training to shape your dog's behavior and encourages upbeat, enthusiastic responses to ensure that your dog will enjoy learning. Teacher's Pet Sessions dog training is fun at both ends of the leash. So listen, learn, and laugh with your dog with Teacher's Pet Sessions. Get your copy of Teacher's Pet Sessions Volume 1 today. To order, go to teacherspetsessions.com.
Hi, this is Pia Silvani, your host. Bring your dog, tug toy, and treats, and get ready to have some fun.
teacherspetsessions.com.
Hi, and welcome to The Family Pet on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Colleen Safford. Each week, we'll focus on different topics: child pet safety, child pet training, just how to make an appropriate pet selection for your family. All of these things will be covered in each one of our episodes. So we hope that you will join us at The Family Pet on Pet Life Radio.
Every week, on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com. Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Weinstein, thank you for being with me today. I do appreciate it.
My pleasure, Bernadine.
So let's go backwards a little bit. When did this issue of local city governments attempting to regulate the practice of veterinary medicine begin?
It goes back to about 2003, 2004, when the city of West Hollywood first brought forth an ordinance that was passed by the city council to ban declawing in the city of West Hollywood. And that passed, and that went to effect approximately 2003, 2004. And that was the first attempt and the first success in a city regulating what a healthcare professional can do within their purview.
To the best of your knowledge, is this the first city or first state in the United States that has tried to regulate what a veterinarian can and cannot do working with the animal owner?
To the best of my knowledge, it is the first city to do that. There may be some other things that have been done, but to the best of my knowledge, it's the first procedure that a veterinarian is approved to do based upon the Practice Act within their state that has been regulated or banned by a city within the United States.
Do you have any idea what was their thinking as to why they thought this was going to be so important, you know, why they, veterinarians, can't declaw a cat?
I think if we go back to the time period, it was really more in line with the perceived pain and suffering and discomfort that a cat is thought to go through as a result of the declaw procedure. The organization or groups of people that were supporting the banning of declawing started out with a direction of focusing on the large cats, the cheetahs, jaguars, mountain lions, tigers, etc., that had been declawed for a variety of reasons. And it must be known that those cats are physically and anatomically different than the domestic cats. But the suffering that those cats went through and the pain that they went through was then extrapolated into the small cat world. And as a result, this ordinance was brought through the city of West Hollywood, focusing on the pain and suffering side of things, not really addressing the benefit that a declawed cat can afford a pet owner, especially a pet owner that might have any of a number of medical problems.
Now, you were mentioning, I think it's very important for people to realize that just because a cat is a cat, they're not. So a lion, a tiger, and a domestic house cat, the way a domestic house cat will pull its claws back, and then when they get scared, poof, those little nails come out. That doesn't happen with a lion and tiger. Their nails are constantly out, and when they get declawed, you are truly maiming them. They can't walk normally. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So with kitties and dogs, too, and all the other animals that I know you were a practicing veterinarian, there are sometimes procedures that are done on animals that for a period of time can cause distress.
Absolutely. And I must say that the veterinary profession has advanced light years in the last 10 to 15 years in our understanding and use of pain management to ensure that pets go through as little pain as possible after a surgical procedure. The protocols have gone from basically no pain management because pets don't feel pain and it's a good way to keep them under control to probably higher levels of pain management than may be used in certain situations in human health care, from preemptive pain management before surgery, intraoperative pain management, post-operative pain management, utilizing drugs that are the same as morphine, for example, people are using. It was funny when my mom was dying of cancer. She was on a fentanyl patch. Well, we were using fentanyl patches all the time in practice to help control the pain that pets were going through as a result of surgical procedures. So I think pain management has come through a huge change, and as a result, the procedures that we're doing, which may be perceived to be painful, we are now helping to control the pain as long as is required to get the cat or dog back on its feet in a pain-free situation.
I will totally concur with you because I didn't graduate from veterinary school in the dark ages, but even when I was going through school, pain medication was rarely given. You're right, they wanted the pets to be a little uncomfortable because they wouldn't move around as much and they wouldn't tear out stitches and they wouldn't bother areas. And then they've gone up the learning curve realizing, no, pain causes stress, they don't heal as well, why have them be uncomfortable? And correct me if I'm wrong, now, for instance, human children, you being a man, when they're still doing the practices of circumcision for baby boys, I don't think they're still using pain medication for that.
Maybe a little bit of wine on the tongue, but that's about it.
So that's definitely ouchy.
Yeah.
How common is declawing? I mean, they really have focused on this. And I know in my own practice, I rarely do declaws. And if I do, it's only the front after I try to talk these people out of declawing their cats.
The Southern California Veterinary Medical Association did a survey of our members. We got about a 20% response rate. And in taking the one of the questions was, how many declaws have you done in the last 12 months? And in averaging the 160 or so useful responses that we got, the average practice is doing about 12 declaws per year, which is about one per month. There were some that were doing 0 to 1 or 2 per year, others that were doing, you know, over 100 per year. But the average amongst the 160 hospitals that we surveyed was 12 per year.
So really very few, and it sounds as though, and from talking to my colleagues, that they try to explain what the procedure is and try to explain, and we'll be talking to Dr. Tripp after this conversation, of some behavioral ways of not having to do declaws. What cities in California, other than West Hollywood, have now banned declaws? Are there a lot of them?
There are 8 in total, including West Hollywood, Berkeley and San Francisco, West Hollywood, the city of Los Angeles, the city of Santa Monica, the city of Beverly Hills, the city of Culver City, and Burbank. So that should be a total of 8.
And if I were a practicing veterinarian following my guidelines as what's been set forth in my code of ethics and practice act, what I cannot do, if I were to declaw a cat in those cities, 8 cities, what could be the possible legal ramifications for me?
Well, these are laws that are now misdemeanors in the cities for performing a declaw. So the penalties, depending upon the city, vary from jail time to a fine or some combination thereof. The Practice Act, which is brought forth by in the state of California by the Department of Consumer Affairs and the Veterinary Medical Board, regulates what veterinarians can or cannot do, as well as what a veterinary practice is supposed to have in terms of minimum standards. The laws within these states, within these cities, are laws that are outside of the Practice Act, because you are allowed to do declaws according to the Practice Act. You are not allowed to do declaws in these cities based upon the laws that they have created. So as a result, you would be facing a legal issue more so than a violation of the Practice Act and the standards that you're set forth by your Department of Consumer Affairs. In human health care, I like to look at it metaphorically. In human health care, you've got the medical board, and the medical board determines whether you're providing an appropriate level of care, and they can take your license away. Well, the Veterinary Medical Board can do the same thing. If you are a plastic surgeon in West Hollywood and the city of West Hollywood banned nose jobs, for example, then you would not be able to do nose jobs in the city of West Hollywood, even though it's absolutely completely legal based upon your licensing board, which is the medical board.
So you bring up the subject in the other medical professions, dental, MDs, chiropractors, etc. Are there rules and regulations set forth by different cities prohibiting them doing certain procedures, certain tasks?
To the best of my knowledge, there are none of the other healthcare professionals that are regulated within cities from doing certain procedures. And to add a little bit more to the story, part of the reason that the seven cities brought these forward towards the end of 2009 was a law passed and signed by the state of California that prevents cities from creating laws that usurp the Practice Acts for the different healthcare professionals. For all the healthcare professionals, this is what the law said, veterinary medicine is considered in those healthcare professionals. So right now, as of January 1, 2010, individual cities cannot create laws that overstep the Healthcare Practice Acts. So this should be an issue that won't go forward from that standpoint, it doesn't preclude that it might not become issues at a state level as opposed to a city or municipality level.
So why are veterinarians so concerned with the passage of these certain cities, these eight cities in California, saying, okay, you can't do a surgery decline, that they don't do that often anyway? Why is there such, you know, the hubbub, the concern about this?
Well, I think that the veterinarians, and again, another number that I would throw out there is in the 10 years or so since I've left practice and become more involved on a management and leadership side of things, the number of declaws has dropped dramatically, and I think a lot of it has to do with awareness. So we have a procedure that's perceived to be painful. We have a procedure that's being done less frequently, but we also have a professional individual who went to school for, on average, about 8 years working with a client and who has brought in their pet, and that is the relationship that I believe veterinarians feel is being violated, the relationship between the doctor and the client in making a decision in the best interest of the cat or dog, and in this case, obviously, the cat, and having somebody else tell us what we can or cannot do when we have been okay to do so by our practice board that basically draws up the rules under which we act. So I think, at least from my standpoint, it's a personal affront that prevents us from working with our clients and making decisions in the best interest of their cats. And in some cases, those cats really are much happier being an indoor cat that's been declawed than an outdoor cat that is coyote fodder.
And they're a lot safer cats. We know they live longer by being that indoor kitty.
Absolutely.
Well, we've been talking right now with Dr. Peter Weinstein, the Executive Director of the Southern California Veterinary Medical Association, giving us a little bit about the legal background of this controversy over declawing domestic cats, and especially the controversy between the relationship, affecting the relationship between a veterinarian and the pet owner. So after the short break, we're going to be right back, and we're going to be talking to Dr. Roland Tripp, a behaviorist, who's going to give us some of the reasons as to why do cats scratch on things and what we can do to try to convince them not to do it. So we'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Greetings, human. What planet am I on?
Welcome to Pet Planet. Here's a copy of Pet Planet magazine, Florida's most informative and fun pet resource magazine. It features heartwarming stories and informative articles from local and national pet experts.
Excellent.
Pet Planet magazine offers Operation Planet Rescue, helping rescued pets find new homes. And it's available at 500 locations in South and Central Florida and 24/7 on the internet at petplanetmagazine.com. If you're out and about with your pet, you may be featured in paparazzi, candid pictures of you and your pet. For up-to-date pet-friendly events, activities, and pet-related services and products, Pet Planet magazine is your final destination.
I shall take this magazine home with me.
Back to your home planet?
No. To my condo in Boca.
Pet Planet Magazine. Check them out at www.petplanetmagazine.com or 352-394-8578. It's out of this world.
Want to know what cats like to eat for breakfast? Mice Krispies, of course. Learn everything there is to know about cats on Catitude with your host, Tom Doc. Each week, we'll spotlight a cool cat breed, give up-to-date advice on cat health, and check out spiffy new cat products. So curl up on the couch every week for a perfectly enjoyable time on Catitude. Every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Welcome back.
Before the break, we were talking to Dr. Peter Weinstein. He's the executive director of the Southern California Veterinary Medical Association. And we were talking about some of the legal aspects of bans that certain cities in California have passed on veterinarians no longer being able to declaw domestic cats. I wanted to read you the background that the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association, has on the position of declawing domestic cats. They feel as though cats should only be declawed after multiple attempts have been made to prevent the cat from using its claws destructively, or when declawing presents a zoonotic risk to the owner. So translated, if you were to have a person that's immune compromised, undergoing chemotherapy, possibly a diabetic, something where a scratch could really have dire consequences, those people, instead of having to give up their cats, may need to consider declawing their cats. The AVMA also believes that it's the obligation of veterinarians to provide cat owners the complete education on what declawing actually involves and some of the alternatives. So my guest right now is veterinary behaviorist Dr. Roland Tripp. And Dr. Tripp, first off, why do cats scratch?
Well, scratching is normal behavior in cats, and there's a whole bunch of reasons that they scratch. People think it's sharpening their claws, and that's only partially true. The way the cat's claw works is it's a little bit more like a snake getting rid of its old skin. In other words, a new claw forms on the underside, and the cat scratches to peel off the old shell. So it's not sharpening like you do with a knife back and forth. But that's one reason, and that only occurs once in a while. Much more often, they are marking their territory. So in the wild, a cat would go up and mark the bark of a tree to say it's like a trespass, no trespassing sign or private property.
It's posted.
That's right. And they post it with not only their claws, but they also do this process to put pheromones from their pads. The sweat glands in the pads of the feet contain a particular scent that is a marker, but that scent marker goes away fairly rapidly, and it's fairly subtle. So what happens is the cats will claw the bark of a tree so that another cat, this is in the wild or perhaps even in a backyard, another cat going by will go, oh, look at that. Oh, I wonder why that tree's marked up. I better go investigate that. So when they get over there, then they find out, oh, there's a scent here. Now, the claws, marking of the tree lasts a long time, but the pheromone, the ointment or the fluid that's pressed from their paws, very small amount, and it's very sensitive, but the point is it wears off. So the combination of the claw plus the pheromone communicates to the next cat coming along whether this territory was previously claimed, and which means this is good territory if somebody went to the trouble of claiming it. And if there's no pheromones on it, then it says, well, no, they've moved out, so there's probably nobody here. Maybe this is something I want to take over. So there's multiple levels of communication being done by this clawing that they do.
Now, people who have declawed cats, you'll oftentimes find they'll have scratching posts for the cat in the home, or they'll go outside, and they're still scratching. But is this because of the pheromone routine?
Well, it's a genetic built-in process. And so, yes, the pheromones are part of it. Some of it is that they just like the feeling of it, the stretching out. Now, it does compromise their ability to stretch, because one of the things they do, separate from anything else, is to hook their claws into something, either carpet on a domestic scratching post or in bark, and then they stretch out. So the stretching, they still want to stretch even if they're declawed. They still want to leave the pheromones if they're declawed. And finally, it's just a normal behavior, so they probably perform it whether or not the claws are there.
So you see these little kitties that come up to you and they want to sit on your lap, and they're, I call, making muffins. And some cats seem to be really good at keeping their claws in, and some of them will make muffins and start kneading on your lap with their nails. Is this going along with the same thing of the pheromone?
Probably not. It's here we're looking at an infantile behavior, which kittens do. The kneading, the making bread or making muffins, if you will, back and forth with the two front paws, what that does is help stimulate milk flow when they're very young. So it is a comforting thing that they do when they're a kitten. It reminds them of their mom. Now, if they were an orphan cat, then they never learned from their mom to stop. Because what happens is, in nature, when the kitten is nursing at first, they have no teeth and mom provides the milk and all is hunky-dory. When they develop teeth, it all of a sudden becomes not so much comfortable. So, as a result, the queen, it's just a female cat, will nudge them away.
And, it's time for you to be weaned.
Time for you to be weaned. And some of it is probably natural timing, and some of it is probably discomfort from the teeth coming in. But the bottom line is that those kittens are less likely to do that mating behavior later on because they learned from their mom to stop it.
Huh.
If they've never learned that, then they may continue. Or they may have a personality that just is very needy, I want to say. double entendre here. And what I mean by that is that if the cat is insecure, you may have a syndrome very similar to what in people is called thumb sucking. So, again, from early on, it has to do with obtaining milk from the breast and so on. So what happens is some of these cats, when they get anxious or nervous, they revert back to that equivalent, human equivalent of thumb sucking. They start putting sucking and kneading and so forth. So it's probably both a fact that learned from their mom, and whether or not they learned it, they may revert to infantile behaviors under times of stress as a coping mechanism.
You'd mentioned a little bit earlier that when they scratch, there seem to be different types of surfaces that they like. And I know when you go to the big pet stores, you'll see jute as, you know, a type of scratching material, and cardboard and different types of rugs and all these different surfaces. Is there one kind of surface that you can say, ah, yes, 99% of the cats prefer to scratch on X?
Well, there are some that are more attractive than others. But the way I would compare it to say is, well, it would be like asking, what kind of music do people like? So there's individual preferences, and so similarly, if just like cats are going to have individual preferences of what they claw on in music, we can say, well, there's what we call popular music. Well, that's what sells the most and is most common for the cat. That's carpet. Okay, that's the most popular and the first one. But there's an awful lot of people that don't like popular music, and they like classical. They like country or rap or whatever. So I think you get into just the realization that these animals are all individual personalities. So rather than try to predict, here's what I would suggest. If you or the listener is going to the store to try to find a scratching post, the bigger stores, I know PetSmart, Petco, and probably others that are large companies, those that have good return policies, that's the point. I would say get one of each, you know, cardboard and bark and so forth, and then if the cat doesn't like it, they won't use it. And if it's not been used, you can return it within 30 days. So I would suggest a simple preference testing for the individual to see, and who knows, maybe they like the equivalent of rap music, you never know.
And looking at the various scratching posts, there's some that you can hang on a door, something small. Those that go floor to ceiling that look like jungle gyms, and they have all these various things. When somebody is looking for a scratching post, you found it likes carpet. What are some of the characteristics of this piece of furniture or that you're going to bring into the house that most cats will say, ah, yes, I like it to be like this?
I like X. Well, I think that there are several considerations, and what I can give you is a general answer on average, but that, again, it's kind of like music. If you're going to say on average this is what sells, but there's going to be variations. So,
Talking about cats, so yes, we know any cat owner. Yeah.
Right, you're talking about cats. On average, they would prefer it be tall and solid and something that works for them and is tall enough to be scratched on. So what I'm getting at is hanging it on the doorknob is a very big compromise. It's better than nothing, so if that's all you can do, that's good. It does get it up high enough and allows the cat to scratch, because what cats like to do is they put their feet down and they stretch their top paws out, they grab a hold of it and they stretch their back out. If the scratching post that you buy is too short, they can't reach up tall enough to get that result. It's just too short. And in order to make a post tall enough for a large cat to stretch all the way out, what happens is it gets top-heavy, and then it falls over on them, which is unattractive.
And then the cat goes, we ain't going back there again.
That's right. So now I've had a bad experience. So the height ideally is tall enough for them to reach out and stretch out. Now, what cats do is they are creative and they make compromises. So if you buy a scratching post that is too short for them to stretch out, what they do is they put their claws as high as they can get and so it can have it be stable, and then they back their back legs out, back until they can stretch out. So there is a compromise that some cats will adapt. But the other consideration is, I think it's interesting that you want to have the orientation of the carpet, if it has an orientation, like Berber does, you know, they have rows and so forth. We want those going up and down instead of sideways, because that assists the cat in removing it. So, in summary, what we want is a tall, preferably floor-to-ceiling, because then it also gives them some place to hide, as well as going plenty tall for them to reach up on. So floor-to-ceiling is the best, but if you have a small apartment, you might have to have something hooked on the door. The other thing is, the final thing I'd say is orientation of the actual object. I mentioned orientation of the carpeting fiber, you know, a moment ago, but you can also have something flat on the ground. And some cats will choose that. That is not the most popular approach, but it's fine to offer that, because the thing that I think is really important is for each person that owns a cat to get to know that cat as an individual and realize that cats are not the same. They have different preferences and different ideas, and if you have two cats, one of them might prefer it flat on the ground, and the other one might prefer, who knows, maybe they prefer the doorknob. I mean, it's going to move around and so forth, but if they like it, they like it. So I think that's the key, is that we all have to begin to think less about what do cats do and what do cats like, and realize that there's a menu of options, and the individual can choose what they want. And that's really what we talk about, is environmental enrichment. It's giving options and letting the cat go, oh, let me see, I think I like this one better than that one. That's really fun for them.
And being a cat, they also like to change their mind, because you have something for a while and they go, ooh, this is really fun. And then they go, nope, don't want to use that anymore. The couch looks better. Or you had mentioned having it large enough. It may be large enough when it's a kitten, but they grow fairly quickly. And all of a sudden, what used to work for the baby isn't going to work for your adult.
Great point. Yes, indeed.
What are some of the other alternatives to decline? So manicure, giving a little manicure and pedicure. A lot of people, and I have to admit, my own cats don't especially appreciate having a manicure done. How can people do it? When should they start?
If you're going to clip the kitten, I mean, to start as a kitten, and if you're going to do it from the time they're a kitten, or for that matter, whenever you start, I think you have to pay them to accept their claws being clipped. Because on their choice, if you just give them their rubbers, they'd prefer that you not hold them still. Now, the reason, let me digress from the one reason they don't like their nails trimmed is because you have to hold the paw still. With a cat, because a cat has a predatory as well as prey mentality, in other words, to a coyote, they're prey, right? They don't like having their feet not available to them, because on a very deep instinctive level, they want to be prepared to run at any moment. So having their foot held for any reason is a undesirable thing. So.
And I thought they were just being stinkers.
Now, when I say pay them, what I mean is with food treats, because food is a currency of life. So if we have something like a little piece of hot dog or a piece of chicken, something that they don't get regularly, that they're saying, yippee yahoo, I want more of that, what it does is it gets their attention on that. So ideally you have two people to do this, and one of them is giving little pieces of food and then teasing a little bit and giving it, but keeping the attention on the food and not on the person, the second person, who is trimming the claws as quickly as they can. And what we want is a positive association.
So when you bring your cat to the veterinarian to have their nails trimmed, they're probably not happy because, number one, I had a car ride. Number two, I was in a carrier. Three, they're trimming my nails, and now I'm having to go back home again and go through that car ride again. So it's a lot better to do it at home.
It is, unless you have an enlightened veterinarian. Now, what I mean by that is that in my school of thought, I'm advocating something called a pet-centered practice. So in a pet-centered practice, that means that they have taken behavioral considerations into effect and they design their visit around the cat's point of view. If that was the case, then this kitten would have come in from the time they were young getting treats, special treats after that. They would see the vet's exam table as a cookie table. They wouldn't remember anything bad happening because they would have used sedation or other distraction techniques. And the handling would be gentle, and the cat would just assume that something good was going to happen, because every time they'd come before, something good was happened, and if they did have to have something that they didn't like, the veterinarian would have taken steps to either distract or sedate or otherwise have the animal not remember it. So it is much harder in cats, let me just say up front, it's much harder in cats to keep them coming back and having them have a good time. It's much easier in dogs, but still, that's the goal in the cat, is to train the owner to have the carrier not be a bad thing, to have treats associated with it. So I think it doesn't have to be a bad thing to have it done by the vet, but certainly it's even better if you do it yourself, because you have to do it every 6 or 7 weeks if you're really keeping up with it.
Besides doing the manicure, the pedicure, what are some of the other alternatives that are available to keep a cat from being declawed?
Well, certainly there are the plastic inserts where you can, after you trim the claw, then you can put a piece of plastic that looks a little bit like a claw with a piece of glue inside of it, a bit of glue, and glue them on. Those are plastic caps. But the best answer is to provide a suitable scratching areas and to reinforce the cat sufficiently for that. And if the cat is scratching inappropriately, then get behavioral assistance to develop a diagnosis, why are they doing it, and then secondly, a treatment plan for what are the steps we need to do to correct it. And I think that the opportunity, for example, these declaw laws that you're describing, I think that the vast majority of those cases, those people that want the cat declawed, are either just mistaken, that they think it's routine and automatic, like getting spayed and neutered. They're just mistaken, in which case education works. Or number two, they're trying to solve a problem, such as their furniture being destroyed, in which case they just need education. Third, even those that are immune compromised, from my vantage point, there's probably many, many other higher priorities. I mean, than the cat's claws. I mean, the cats can be trained or can be, you know, handled. I think it's very rare that that would need to be done. It might be individuals, because they're all individuals. I'm not saying it shouldn't be in there, but I'm just saying it's really, really rare and unusual. The big one is the fact that the cat's just mistaken. The owners have not provided suitable scratching. And then I want to say one more thing. Once in a while, you do have an individual animal who has their individual personality. It's who they are. I am, therefore I scratch. So just like some people, you know, you can be a musician or an artist or a tennis player or an accountant or whatever, you know, whatever drives you to your genetic code. So some of those cats, if you have them inside the house and you insist on them being inside the house, some of those are better off declawed, because otherwise they just can't survive. So either they, you could get them a new home, you could go have them live on a ranch someplace, or you could have it be an outdoor cat some of the times. Now that depends on where you live and the circumstances, but generally being outdoors is a bigger risk, because either you get eaten, or you get run over, or you get lost, or some other, or you get sick. So there's all sorts of reasons that we don't routinely anymore have cats outdoors, but those are all choices that can be made.
Dr. Tripp, if you have one of these I am, therefore I scratch cats that you really need to keep indoors, and you've offered the scratching post and you've tried all the various ones, and this cat says, you know, the couch is really what I want to scratch on, what are some of the deterrents that you can put on couches, on furniture, or wherever else your cat decides it wants to mark and make its own?
Well, in terms of a behavioral strategy, if you're trying to make deterrence, we always want to link a deterrent with an alternative. So that's a key concept, is if you put a deterrent, such I'll describe those in a second. If you put a deterrent on the edge of the couch where they've been scratching, it's critical that right next to that you give them a new suitable scratching post. And the way you know it's suitable is because you've done scratching preference, substrate preference testing. What that means is that if you have bat cat, the I am, therefore I scratch cat, and you've tried other things, and then at some point you've got to do preference testing. That means you lock them in a room, with a comfy room with beds and food and water and so forth, but with about 3 or 4 or 5 different scratching posts. So you have to find out what is the one that they like, then because they use it. Then you take that one or one like it, and you put that right next to the area that you want to use to deter them away from. So now we've given them a good alternative. We've taken care of their needs first. So now we can, in good faith, make the old target undesirable. So what are some ways to do that? Well, you can put aluminum foil. Well, aluminum foil is very likely to make them not want to scratch, but it isn't the best home design look, okay? So interior design, I should say.
It's not very feng shui, yes.
Not feng shui by a long shot. So the next least worst option is to do double-sided tape, okay? Not as bad as aluminum foil, still not exactly feng shui, but it's an alternative. Double-sided tape, it's sticky, they don't like it. Probably a little better than that would be scent. So what you want to do is put something that is offensive to the cat, but not so much to a person. For that, potpourri is the first thing I would try, because that's many people actually like the scent of potpourri, and cats seem to not like it, so that's a trade-up. So rubbing a little bit of that into the area may work for some cats. If not, then onion is another one, where the cat's sense of smell is so much tighter that that may be repelling to them. Going up the scent deterrent scale, finally we get to Vicks VapoRub or something like that that people can smell, but it'll go away for people before it will for the cats. Those are all scent deterrents. So then we turn to the next one, which would be surface. That is the surface in which they're standing. And here what we would do is buy some carpet runner from Home Depot and cut out, just need about a foot of it, and you can cut it to the shape that you want, and you just position it so the cat won't stand on upside-down carpet runner, because they're little sharp things there. You just make it unpleasant for them to do it, and at the same time, you're providing them a very pleasant alternative right next door. So once they're using the new one and you can reward it, you can still move that. Now, you can move that scratching post no more than a foot a day for most cats. That's a rule of thumb. But you could still gradually move it more where you want it. And if you leave the deterrent there, then we should be doing fine.
Just remember not to be barefoot when you walk over that carpet runner and in the middle of the night.
Well,
yes.
You'll only do that once.
We'll learn, we hope, yes. Well, Dr. Tripp, this is some great information. It helps me as I'm sitting here with my cat on my lap and looking at its little claws going, oh, we're going to finish this conversation and trim those little suckers. They're long. Very good information because, yes, veterinarians, I have a feeling, as a general rule, do not like declawing cats or causing pain or discomfort for any of our patients. So knowing there's alternatives, it's going to take some work, it's going to take some effort, and start when they're young is probably the best information you could probably give recommendation. I think you've just given us great places to start, and hopefully we don't have too many of those cats that scratch, and therefore they are.
My pleasure.
So thank you so much. You've been listening to The Pet Doctor. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Hopefully you listen again next week to Pet Life Radio. And thank you, Mark, the producer, for putting together a great show. We'll chat with you again next week. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.